I'm correspondent Tom Wilmer. Come along and join me for an illuminating conversation with Eric Chaya, a U.S. Army Special Forces major who's leading Monterey, California's Naval Postgraduate School's Regenerative Grazing Open Air Lab, known as R-GOAL, on 2,500 acres at Camp San Luis Obispo, California. The cattle grazing operation is a model for potential expansion across 26 million acres under the management of the Department of Defense. Using adaptive multi-paddock grazing, the project leverages variable stock densities to reduce fuel loads, preventing wildfires, while revitalizing training areas, enhancing warfighter proficiency, and simultaneously improving water infiltration. R-GOAL establishes baseline metrics with ongoing evaluations to demonstrate scalability and operational benefits, unlocking the full potential of regenerative grazing on DoD installations offers immense opportunities, strengthening the warfighter, enhancing military training lands while delivering long-term benefits for military readiness and local communities across vast untapped acres.
My name is Eric Chaya. I'm an Army major, faculty member at the Naval Postgraduate School. That's where I work right now. And I get to call Camp San Luis Obispo right now home. Incredible, as we're running a research project here. It's really a proof of concept for the Army. We have a herd that's here that consists of 140 cow-calf pairs. And we're the first ever Army regenerative grazing proof of concept here. I'll back up and a little bit about me. I grew up in Wisconsin, not on a farm or anything. Got all the glorious jobs of what you do in the summer when you live in dairy country, and that's baling alfalfa and cleaning out stalls and gutters. You know, the real fun, good jobs that make you want to stay in agriculture. Not really. So I had done some really cool school projects. I'd shared some of them with you, read a book called Foot Soldier in eighth grade, and said, I want to be an infantryman. Like, that's my goal.
So it got you in the eighth grade.
Eighth grade, wow. I knew it. Well, I should say there were two things. You know, I either wanted to be a fighter pilot, because I read about the Battle of Britain, and I thought, whoa, how cool is that? Like, defending your homeland like that. And didn't necessarily have the grades for the Air Force Academy. And turns out there's very few pilots. And so I thought, well, infantry is a great, I wouldn't say it's like, it was my second. I'd read that book and thought, you know, that's where the action is. That's where I want to be. So in eighth grade, I started thinking about, you know, what I can do to make sure I end up an infantryman, and ended up learning about Army ROTC, Reserve Officer Training Corps, and they pay for college. I'd done an interview at Marquette University, which is in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and was offered a full ride scholarship. Not a cheap school, but I wasn't going to go there without that.
So you graduated second lieutenant?
Yep, second lieutenant.
And immediately went active duty?
Yep, went active duty, went right to Fort Benning, which is now Fort Moore, and started an infantry officer basic course. You know, you do the airborne school, you do the ranger school, the infantry officer pipeline, went through that, and then was a platoon leader out at Fort Lewis, Washington, where we rode around in strikers, which was a great experience.
Explain the striker. That's a real versatile.
It is extremely versatile. When it's working, it's an incredible vehicle. Mm-hmm. And, you know, just talk about an awesome mobile support by fire. And so when you get some drivers, and we call them vehicle commanders, when they can get understand, you know, a base of fire maneuver, it's incredible.
Barrel, is that a 50 cal?
Well, it is. I should say it was.
Okay.
And then they switched to 30 millimeter. I mean, there's all sorts of different variants too, but Stryker, extremely capable vehicle. We always stressed that it wasn't necessarily the platform that made a Stryker brigade. We said the most powerful thing about a Stryker brigade was the 9-man infantry squad. We still stressed the basics. We were still infantrymen who just happened to have a really capable platform.
You'd have 9 troops inside of the Striker?
Right, inside, right. Yep. As that back door would drop down. Yeah. And then you had your mobile support by fire, base of fire maneuver.
You could do medevac, evac too, right?
Yeah, we had MEVs, so that's another variant, the medical variant of the Striker. ATGMs, anti-tank guided missiles, we had engineer variants that you got to see. So there's all sorts of different variants of that same platform.
So when you deployed, where did you go?
Well, I never deployed as an infantryman. I really felt like I'd missed out. And to me, the next logical progression was to go to Special Forces Assessment and Selection. They were still getting after it. And so that was my best opportunity, I thought, to go.
So that was Ranger School?
Well, Ranger School was before all that. So that was even before I was a platoon leader. We were always told that you want to show up with a Ranger tab to your infantry battalion, and you'll get a platoon. If you don't, there's chances you'll sit on staff for a while and have to row pretty hard just to prove that you're capable to lead one of those platoons for that battalion commander. Yeah, went through Ranger School, then eventually did my time as a infantry platoon leader. Then I was a reconnaissance platoon leader. I was a company executive officer. And then, again, we weren't deploying. We weren't on the schedule to deploy. So I thought Special Forces Assessment and Selection is the next logical progression. It's where I'd like to pursue a career in Special Forces.
And you did that?
Yeah. I was really blessed to do that. I absolutely mean this, and I believe I'm the most average Green Beret out there. I mean, throughout the course, I couldn't believe how hard I had to work to be so average. I mean, just some incredible, incredible people there.
Little superhumans.
Oh, they really are. Even in selection. So we're halfway through, and, you know, there's about 120 of us in this selection class. And I just remember thinking, there's going to be a small fraction of us who actually get selected, but this group of 120, I mean, I'd never been part of a, you know, that would be an infantry company that could be extremely formidable. And we're only going to take a small fraction and let them then go through another 2-year course that will weed out even more to then land them on a 12-man operational detachment alpha.
Oh, 10%.
Very, very fortunate to be part of it and to eventually make it onto an ODA.
Would it be on parallel with the Navy SEAL?
Their direct action force, we often kind of get compared as, you know, we're the Army's version of that, but different mission set. They're looking for different type of people too. I mean, they're very capable at what they do.
So how did you go from there to Monterey?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I did my time as, and they call it a team leader or a detachment commander in 3rd Special Forces Group. That's at Fort Bragg, which so enjoyed my time there. Got to go Africa and Afghanistan, incredible experience there. And I come back and I take a job as a general's aide. Never thought that would be something I would do.
Like aide de camp?
An aide de camp. Uh-huh. Yeah, I became an aide de camp for the U.S. Army Special Operations Command Deputy Commanding General. His name's General Steve Marks. You know, what a incredible opportunity that was, because, I mean, I learned a ton from him. Just being able to be around a person like that.
Shadowing.
High caliber. And we'd leave these meetings with some high-level engagements, and we'd be in the car, and I'm driving, you know, the general, some colonels, and we get in the car, and the first thing that comes out of his mouth, "What'd you think of that meeting?" Whoa. You know, I'm like, whoa, you know. Or we'd be in one of those conferences, and maybe a decision brief, or they're trying to get the general's guidance on whatever it is they're presenting to him. He was really good about not putting me on the spot. He'd start by saying, "Hey, when I was fresh off a team, I was very connected. I had a unique context. I understood these things. And that's why when I choose an aide, I want someone right off." And I knew when he started talking like that, oh, he's about to put me, hopefully I was really paying attention, because he's going to turn around and ask me what I think of this. So it was, I mean, what an invaluable position. And I loved that he said, you know, "I'm finally in a position where I can really help people." I mean, that was like his mentoring people would just invigorate him. And so I just...
Still in touch with him?
Oh, yeah, yeah. We were actually just texting the other day about what... He's at SOCOM. He's a SOCOM J8 now. So dealing with a lot of big, big money issues, and not just for Army, but for the whole Joint Force, for all of Special Operations Command. And yeah, so we're still in touch with him and still talk to him. And I definitely bounce ideas off him. Mm-hmm. That's another benefit. I, again, never thought I'd want to be an aide. And I can't say I went into the interview thinking I would do it. But that's a long way, a long intro into another benefit that of being a general's aide was I was exposed to all these different opportunities that you can do for intermediate level education. So all us majors have to go through, typically, you go to Fort Leavenworth, Kansas, to the Command General Staff College. And I was planning on either doing that or staying at Fort Bragg to do National Defense University. And General Marks had gone to the Naval Postgraduate School in Monterey, and he said, Eric, I really think you should consider that. You know, you should consider doing it. And I said, sir, you know, we have a home here. We have some acreage. I was doing some farming on the side. You know, I'd come back from work. I'd move my cows. I'd feed my chickens. I'd move the pigs, all those type of things. And so I said, sir, I'm homesteading here. You know, I don't want to pick up and leave. And he said, hey, let's go out there. You know, we'd been invited to come take some briefs. What they like is because students who are there are in Army Special Operations, and they have some pretty cool thesis ideas, and they wanted to present some of their ideas to him, some of the ongoing research. And so he's like, all right, let's take these briefs, and I want you to go out there, and I want you to go, you know, I want you to run around the neighborhood. I want you to run down by the beach. I want you to check out these things. So he kind of was a tour guide for a little bit of it, and I ran through the neighborhoods, and I'm running through the family housing, and there's like packs of Disney princesses running around. And I have, like I told you, I have four daughters. And I thought, well, this would be like, what a unique experience for my daughters to have, to kind of get off the homestead and to go be around all these kids. And not to mention, Monterey is, it's a pretty unique Army assignment to be in a location like that.
No kidding.
Yeah. Well, I'm getting pretty spoiled here. Now I'm at Camp San Luis Obispo. So I've gotten two incredible assignments back to back.
But you're still based in Monterey.
Yes. Yep. Still based in Monterey. Yeah. Again, doing the research here.
So talk to us about your research. What's the point of the exercise?
I'll start by saying just another kudos to the Naval Postgraduate School. Not only is it an incredible location, but they allowed us students to take things we've seen, operational experience, and apply it to our thesis. You know, it's not a canned, you will work on this.
Right.
They want to say, hey, what did you experience? And what can we as, you know, because we're joint, we're very joint at MPS, what can the Joint Force do about it? And so I kind of mentioned I was doing some homesteading and raising our own meat. You know, I was looking at kind of like food security, high quality, nutrient dense food that I didn't have to worry about like scouring the labels because it's grown in my backyard. I know what went into it. And so when I'd go to these countries, you know, when I'm in Africa and I'm talking to my partner force, who's a battalion commander, I can speak his language, you know, not just literally, but also like I can talk about agriculture because that matters to him. Because there's very little insulation between a drought and how well that partner force eats. You know, it's not like here where those 18-wheelers are going to keep rolling in from wherever they're coming from.
Right.
We're going to eat. It's going to be all right. Or we have, you know, stored MREs. We'll get on the MRE train and we'll be okay. I was seeing like, that's not the case. What did Napoleon say? The Army runs on its stomach. I thought we really need to be concerned with how we're managing our land. And as I was diving more into this agriculture stuff, I really thought, well, all this food stuff, you know, it actually starts in the soil. It starts below our feet in this hidden, you know, microscopic world. Mm-hmm. Underneath our feet.
But the ultimate point of the exercise has to do with you are deployed in Afghanistan, say.
Yep.
And you're in a very remote area.
Mm-hmm.
So it has to do with, again, with in the field with sourcing and securing foodstuffs.
Yes.
Talk to us how that is applied there. So you're working with local farmers.
Well, that is what I saw we were potentially missing. My partner force, you know, our ODA is out there in the hinterlands, right? We're out there in the country and we're partnering with a partner force and we're teaching troop leading procedures. We're teaching raids. We're teaching ambushes, which is very important. And then I always felt like I could develop unique rapport because I would also say, Hey, talk to me about what you're growing out there. What's your animal husbandry practices are like? Are you reliant on these chemicals that I've become familiar with that I've decided, you know, we don't necessarily need to rely on those? And I was just struck by how similar some of their practices were to what we were doing. They had things that were not necessarily within their local context, but because we were there, we could offer them those. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was thinking, as we know in Afghanistan, we can't be there forever, right? I'm thinking that as I'm there. And so their practices are pretty reliant on what we're providing them. And what happens when we leave? Mm-hmm. You know, like we want to have an episodic engagement, but there's no way we're going to be able to just stay here forever. So we need to approach them with some locally adapted means of providing for themselves. And, you know, we look at the hierarchy of needs, right? And food, security, those are right there. And so we thought we need to be talking about how they can provide food on their own. You know, it's first, you know, the old saying, you can give a man a fish or teach him to fish. And so we really thought that knowledge should be our number one export, not these packaged up boxes of, you know, chemicals or fertilizer.
Yeah. So talk to us about what your mission is here, mm-hmm. right behind us in the fields with the cows.
Yeah.
Range management and mm-hmm. whatnot, what you're trying to learn and accomplish.
Yep. So if you're picking up a agriculture-related magazine, so to speak, there's going to be the term regenerative agriculture. That's going to be in it. And so for our thesis, we said, well, let's talk about how we can ultimately, again, internationally, how do we create stability in areas of instability? But just like any good advisor, I've had two really good advisors who were like, all right, Eric, we need to neck this thing down because it can't be, that's too big. You're going to be writing a million pages. Let's neck it down. And so we chose to focus on our own installation. So we thought, we as the DOD have 26.9 million acres, the Army alone, 13 million. Me and my thesis partner, Ian McAlpine, we're like, well, let's focus on the Army. You know, we can kind of, that's what we can bite off. We have those connections. Let's look at how we can implement this practice, this regenerative agriculture, on DOD land. And then to further neck it down, we chose to focus on the most ubiquitous activity that happens on agriculture activity that happens on DOD installations, and that's grazing.
Implicit is erosion.
Exactly, right? That is one of the things we're getting after. And that's what we're seeing here is, like, we have areas that are heavily eroded, you know, not out here so bad, but we're like, okay, well, we can utilize the grazing as a tool to reduce erosion.
And that has to do with rotating?
Yes. We chose to implement a practice called adaptive multi-paddock grazing, AMP. AMP grazing for short, because we all love acronyms, you know, so agriculture is no different. So that's what we're doing out here. That, you know, a listener may hear a moo or two as these mama cows are gathering their calves up right now. But this is a practice where we get often compared to rotational grazing. And there is some similarities there, but it's adaptive because we're out there every single day, and where it's not prescriptive, so there isn't a set amount of acreage that I'm going to give them for that day. Mm-hmm. It's extremely adaptive,
so
right?
It depends on environmental conditions that you observe in the field, correct?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah, exactly. So we go out there, we measure forage, we look at the animals, you know, their performance, their body condition, and then we construct with a piece of poly wire. It's a white wire with metal filament. And we use these little step-in posts. And so it's really low cost and fairly simple to implement. And so we have these large, you know, Camp San Luis Obispo, 2,500 acres of grazing, where the typical and conventional grazing practice would give them all of that. The cows would kind of move on their own. And what we're seeing is when we control that, when we implement this, these cows, some of them, some days they're on 8 acres.
Wow.
And that's all they have. And so what that's doing is it's targeting the grazing. So if we have eroded areas, like you mentioned, we can really get some impact in there to soften up those edges, to slow down water when it comes down. You know, that hoof impact, the manure, the urine, that all is feeding the microbiology that is fairly non-existent on that bare soil. So we're putting some organic matter down to slow down the water when it does come. Then what we're looking for is, you know, some root development, and that really can start feeding the microbiology.
The other day, you mentioned about controlling and navigating your herd via satellite.
Yeah. I mean, we're definitely talking with some companies about, I really think it's going to revolutionize the grazing industry as a whole, but virtual fencing.
So these cows are going to have a collar?
Cows will have a collar. And then instead of me being out here, don't get me wrong, I do love being outside and walking around with this poly wire and putting in these step-in posts, but the thought of being able to increase my kind of constant keen observation and spending more time doing that versus putting in posts, and then having my computer out here and able to move the fence with the computer, with the satellite that now moves and communicates to those collars, which give audio, and then it does give them a little bit of a shock if they're outside.
So it's outside. Kind of like a dog collar.
You know, if minus the buried wire, It looks just like those dog collars. Yeah, exactly. It's unbelievable.
They're calling you right now.
I can hear them. Yeah, they know that they're supposed to be getting moved. Yeah, in about 30 minutes is a typical movement. We like to wait until the afternoon, the height of the sun. There's a thing called Brix, B-R-I-X. It's like the energy source in the grass is highest at this point. So ideally, this is when we're moving them each day. And so the girls, I can hear them saying, I think you're pretty close, Eric. Let's get going here.
That's so funny.
Yeah.
Do they like you?
I really think they do. They definitely associate us with something positive.
Like food?
Like food, exactly. And it's interesting that we have two vehicles that we ride out there. I have an ATV and we have a typical, your just average four-wheeler, and then we have a UTV. And so the way we move them is we have the UTV usually goes up there and opens the gate, and then the four-wheeler, if we need it, if they're not all moving, the four-wheeler will come out behind them. And so
to push them,
exactly, like some of the stragglers, if there are any. So we're getting to the point now where, you know, we've been doing this about 4 months, and so when they see the UTV, we call it the gut truck. You know, like they see that and they know, okay, we're about to go to greener grass, greener pastures, so let's start moving.
So they respond. That's really
cool. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And they respond if they can see us, and they can hear us for sure. But we've also incorporated a whistle. So a whistle and the UTV, that really gets them moving. Now, when they hear the four-wheeler fire up, then they're like, all right, I got to grab the calf. It's time to go. So I think we get a lot of pushback when we talk to, you know, maybe some like ranchers who say, oh, I don't want, this is so much time. I don't have all the time to do this. And it really doesn't take that long. You know, the cows are moving themselves, Right. Really. We just open the gate. And then I'm able, every single day, I get to see body condition. I get to see who's limping. You know, if there's a calf who's not doing well, is hanging behind, you know, I got my little notebook. I can say, you know, ear tag 32, her calf's not doing so good. You know, so that is for a rancher who has to drive out on 2,500 acres and try and find all of them and get a good look.
Do you have to reach out to civilian veterinarians?
Or
do you have any military vets?
You know, we would love to get there. And as we talk about expanding this project, you know, right now, you know, why are we doing this here on DOD land? Yes, we have like that long-term vision of international stability, but we have this huge untapped resource here. We have the data, we have the science. We know that this is not just an environmentally beneficial practice, but this also increases the bottom line for our farmers and ranchers. And so we really talk about, you know, non-commissioned officers are the backbone of the Army, and I'm a firm believer in that. And I really think agriculture is the backbone of our economy here in the United States. And so we need to promote practices that are going to keep these farmers and ranchers in business.
Let me interrupt for a moment, because we're on Camp San Luis Obispo. That's right outside of the city of San Luis on Highway 1.
Mm-hmm.
Most people that drive by on Highway 1, they see the main cantonment of the base, the barracks and whatnot.
Right.
What 90% of people have no clue of is that Camp San Luis land goes almost all the way up to Cuesta Ridge.
Right.
Correct?
Mm-hmm.
So over your shoulder, all those foothills and rising mountains, that's all part of the base.
That's right.
Interesting.
It is. I mean, it goes way back. Yeah, if you haven't been out to the ranges, and this is interesting because I'm talking to local folks about what we're doing, and they're asking questions, and they're like, "Well, where are you grazing?"
Right,
you know,
right.
I'm like, "It's actually fairly large. You know, it's 4,500 acres total. We say 2,500 is grazable. 2,500 is what we're responsible for, and fuel load reduction is like our number one goal out here, and that's even in the lease." is that's why we're doing it, is, you know, removing some invasive species and we're doing fuel load reduction, which is absolutely clear.
That's relative to fire.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. Fuel load. So what we've really been impressed by was that this new practice, so grazing has been going on Camp San Luis Obispo for a long time, right? It was the Jack Ranch before it was Camp San Luis Obispo. And so grazing is synonymous with this area. But with all of that grazing for really a long time, there becomes areas where the cows just aren't interested in going, right? The grass, for whatever reason, just not palatable, not super nutritious potentially, or for whatever reason, they're not wanting to go up there because it's uncomfortable to walk up that hill. So they're not going to walk up it. I think one thing that was really interesting when I had the rancher, Mark Simonin, who's been just, you know, the partner of choice, if I could have one, right? He's been incredibly receptive to what I'm doing. I'm not going to say we didn't make him nervous a few times, because this is very different from what is typically done out here. But there's a hillside, you would know where it is, but it's right up there by the corrals. And the cows have not really grazed it in quite some time. And it's kind of long, thatchy. Picture those long, brown, oxidized grass. It's tinder. Picture a fuel load, that's what it is.
But there isn't much nutrition left.
Right, there's not, but there is a lot of, the cow does need just dry matter.
Forage. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah. It just needs some forage too. So again, this was one of the smallest, because this hillside was so long and rank, we said, all right, let's get these cows up there, because underneath there is some good green feed, but it's just not able to express itself because of how long it's been since it's been grazed. So we put them on that 8-acre little postage stamp. You know, you got 140 cows plus their calves, right? So that's a lot of
lawn mowing.
That's a lot of lawn mowing going on there. And so that is up there. And that was like his first aha moment to say, whoa, this is really different. This is really, they're able to knock all that down, take down all that duff, thatch, low quality feed. And then they convert it though. It's low quality, but as we're moving them to fresh forage every day, they take in some of the highly nutritious stuff, and they take some of the lower quality stuff as well, because it's non-selective grazing. You know, there's a level of competition that we introduce there, so they're just getting in there and start biting and grabbing, and
that's really cool.
Yeah, it is really neat to see the behavior change.
Do you partner with your neighbor Cal Poly in their ag management?
You know, I'll be honest, I wasn't sure about them initially. And I'm like, you know, universities sometimes, you know, it's kind of depends of who's funding the research. Mm-hmm. That kind of always goes back to that. And I got to meet Aaron Lazaroff, who's their beef center manager over there.
Yeah.
And I was blown away. They're doing similar to what we're doing. They have a lot of paddocks internally fenced. They can do the more permanent interior fencing, whereas here, you know, I'm grazing a land nav site, so 24 hours later, you're not going to know we had cows there, right? Other than there's going to be some manure, but hey, train like you fight is what I like to say. So Cal Poly, I mean, they're moving them every 2-3 days.
Wow.
And they actually have a really functioning ecosystem over there. It actually looks really good. Yeah. I'm really impressed with Cal Poly.
They really mitigated their erosion.
Oh, yeah. I mean, cattle, that's the thing. We're talking about utilizing cattle as land management versus land as cattle management, right? It's not an extractive model. We actually are providing a service. When we talk about dust and erosion or those thatch, I've sat on ranges, right? A tracer round hits a dry patch of grass, starts a fire, and guess what? Shutting it down, guys. We got to sit on our hand. We got to wait for the fire department to get out here, put this fire out. But, you know, range maintenance is part of their system. I mean, you'll see a code in there like, oh, I can't utilize this range today because it's under range maintenance. And what we're proposing is we can incorporate these livestock into that. We can target them. We have very, very tight control of these cows. As we speak, you know, the old general officer quarters up here over the hill on the other side of the officer club, you know, we got a single poly wire. They're outside of their typical fence line.
And are they up there now?
There's a few in there. I think they all ran up the hill when they saw the UTV, so they just kind of like bombed toward the UTV. But we put them right in there, and, you know, yesterday the landscape crew saw me as I was out there on my four-wheeler, and I thought, oh, boy, here they're going to come yell at me. You know, I'm not supposed to have cows out here. And they came over, and they said, hey, we just really want to thank you.
Oh,
like,
because
it's steep. Like, we're not grazing the part that they mow. We're grazing the part that they just have to do periodically. And they got to be out here with, you know, it's steep. So they're with weed whackers. They're not out here with their nice John Deere riding mower, right? They're out here with weed whackers, and they're like, that's really tough to get to. And frankly, it eats up a ton of our time. We're so thankful to see that, you know, you guys can benefit, and it helps us out too. So we just appreciate it. So you kind of see like these win-wins from unexpected places, which has been really fun.
Looking forward, perfect world, What have you not accomplished that you would like to?
Yeah, so what keeps me up at night? Yeah, what's the vision?
Exactly.
Yeah. I know that post-Army career, I'm going to be involved in agriculture. This is going to be my next mission. I really think this is a great place for veterans in particular. We understand the value of hard work. We like being outside. It's healing to be out there. I was on a free fall team, right? So we did a lot of skydiving, and you know, you can have a day where you're skydiving in the morning and then you're shooting at the range later that day. It's just like draining, takes a lot out of you, and you know, you get these adrenaline dumps and headaches. And so coming out here, or out there in North Carolina in that case, and you know, I'd come back from work, I'd move my cows to a fresh piece of grass and
clear your brain.
Oh man, talk about like, and you know, you're stewarding this environment. You know, the acreage I owned, I know I was making it a better place, hoping to pass it on to whoever we end up selling to one day, better than how I got it. And that's what we want to do here too.
Because you do know, you know the drill, is that you never own land.
That's right.
You are a steward.
That's right.
Best.
Yeah. Yeah. The steward. So this is another General Marks, the guy I was an aide for. His name's Bob Chapman. He was like one of the top leaders, according to like Business Inc. or I think it was Inc. magazine or something. He was like, what's the definition of leadership? And he would ask me, you know, Eric, what's your definition of leadership? And we would use his definition, which is, definition of leadership is stewarding the lives entrusted to you or to me. You know, like we're stewarding the lives of the people around us, just like we're stewarding this environment out here too. And so when I think about how can this continue beyond my tenure here, I think about incorporating veterans. There's these principles of soil health that I adhere to out here. And the very first one is context. So I always think I'm able to understand the unique context that training is first and foremost out here. And I mean, that's why I'm out here. I want to create these ranges. I want ranges that can withstand heavy abuse training, because we're here to fight and win our nation's war. That's what we have an army for, a standing army for. And so these cows are an incredible tool to be able to create that. You know, we can keep training on these grounds because we're removing all this fuel load, which has been something really incredible. We can keep training because we have all this reduced erosion because of this tool that we're using out here. You know, long term, what haven't I accomplished? We really want to, we're working with a company called the Hinterland Institute, and we are figuring out.
What's their mission?
Well, so they really got started by these two guys, also Army veterans. One of them, he's a lawyer, he's a JAG and a serial entrepreneur, right? And the other guy actually worked for the Buffett Foundation. He farmed in Africa, was a farm manager for 6 years. And so both of them are in the Army Reserves. And so I got connected with them and they say, hey, these guys are talking about agriculture internationally, just like you do, you need to talk to them. And we got together and like, it was just a buzz of energy in that room. Their passion is that we can train US Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force personnel going overseas and some of the basics of agriculture, because that's the language they speak, right? And that's sometimes they need advice about that. And so let's figure out what are the best practices that we're doing here, and then how do we locally adapt them for their context. So that's what Hinterland wants to do. And then we're talking to them about how we incorporate veterans here. And, you know, this vision I have of, we're out here moving cows and we have the skill bridge, which are, you know, your last 6 months in the Army, it's on the job training, you're still in the Army, but you know you want a career in agriculture. Well, come out here, you're going to work with us side by side, you're going to learn the ropes, and then, you know, we'll partner you with some of the biggest ranches. Or what I'd love is that these DOD land managers, that's what we're creating. We're creating a cadre of DOD land managers who understand the unique training environment that they're in and how to implement the best class of livestock in order to ensure that readiness is our number one goal, that we can keep these guys training.
Looking around the country, how many other installations in North America are doing a similar thing that you're doing?
Well, none. I mean, I shouldn't say that. Marine Corps Air Station Yuma, they have probably one of the best grazers in the world. His name's Alejandro Carrillo. They're doing a grazing project similar to ours, but they're doing it obviously in the desert. They're actually having to bring in a lot of forage, so a lot of hay, so they can get the impact they want, because there's really not a whole lot out. So they're trying to regreen the desert, which is really impressive. Thanks to the last 2 years, I mean, the last 2 years, we've had really good rain here.
And so up McCord, Fort Lewis, are they doing anything?
They do not. They do not have a grazing lease. There's a lot of reasons why certain bases aren't grazing. And I often think they think it's going to be a distraction from training. But that's where I want to get people out here. You know, we had our sponsor, who's the Assistant Secretary of the Army for Installations, Energy, and Environment. They sent a Ranger Regiment guy. His name's Colonel Chris Vitale. Sent him out here to kind of see what we're doing. You know, we laid some of the poly wire on the ground. I was like, all right, Colonel Vitale, I want to show you kind of this level of control that we have of these livestock. I brought him out for a day in the life. You know, he had cows sticking their head in the UTV looking at it. He works in the Pentagon, so he's like, you know, he's loving it, right? And those cows didn't want to go over that. You know, they didn't want to step over that.
And was it visual?
They see that white wire, and they don't really want to mess with it. You know, we call it poly wire. I think, you know, when the cows are all talking with themselves, they call it the devil's lace.
Right.
It's some potent stuff, right? And they have four hooves and a wet nose.
Yeah.
I mean, they're grounded when they touch that thing. So they don't mess with it anymore, you know? And so when he saw that, he was like, you know what? I got it. This has got a bunch of environmental benefits. This is good for the base. It can generate revenue for the installation. You know, I'm seeing all these deer and turkey that are now coming here that the rancher, you know, who's been here 20 years, he's like, I can't believe how many turkeys are out here now.
What's attracting them?
Well, turkeys are nature's pest management, right? And so we have this big herd of cows leaving piles of dung. You know, now we have these turkeys who are like, hey, these guys must be on a schedule because it's a buffet and we just need to follow them. And so, again, we've been doing this 4 months. So to me, this is just kind of normal seeing all these turkeys right out here. But Mark was kind of blown away. And even I asked some of the range maintenance guys and some of the security forces guys who come out here. And I'm like, hey, you see that flock of turkeys out there? And they're like, it's quadrupled in size. You know, so when we talk about, yes, this makes sense on DOD land, but also for kind of some of those bigger landowners who are into hunting, I'm like, this is a great practice if you want to start drawing in some wildlife. You know, deer are out here like crazy now. We're seeing them come out, whereas they used to kind of stick to the bushes. We joke and say we're managing multiple herds,
right?
You know, because those deer and turkeys, they just stay a few days behind because we remove all that thatchy, undesirable stuff, and they're like, oh, this is all this lush green grass growing after this. Yeah, I'll keep following these guys.
That's really cool.
Yeah.
So let's do part two coming up.
Okay.
In the meantime, Derek, to learn more about your world, where are you take us?
You know, we have a LinkedIn page. It's called Our Goal, Our Regenerative Grazing Open Air Lab. So Our Goals, and, you know, we love acronyms. I already said that. Our LinkedIn page, we post a lot of our situation reports, and we post photos, too, of what we're doing out here. What I like about it is some of the biggest names in regenerative agriculture and regenerative grazing are on there, and they can look at that, and they see something. You know, the layman can look at it and think, wow, that's really neat what you're doing. I mean, it's kind of putting it all out there, right? Because when they see pictures, they can really pick it apart. But that's what we want, right? We want to be able to get better. And so when I'm able to post those things, I get feedback from some of the industry's best and brightest.
That's really cool.
It's really cool, yeah. My name is Major Eric Chaya, U.S. Army. Again, Tom, just really thank you for doing this.
My pleasure, really my honor. Well, we'll see you next time. I'm your host, Tom Wilmer, reporting from Camp San Luis Obispo.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.
This is Roseanne Cash, and I'm sitting here with Tom Wilmer. Please support your local NPR station.
I listen to WNYC in New York. In fact, NPR is all I listen to. If I didn't have NPR, I would feel like my lifeline to the world has been cut. So, yes, please support your local NPR station.
Being there matters, and your United States Navy protects and defends America on the world's oceans. Around the globe, around the clock, Navy ships, submarines, aircraft, and most importantly, tens of thousands of America's finest young men and women are ready to defend America when piracy threatens global commerce, when disaster strikes, or when called upon by the Commander-in-Chief, your Navy is there. When it comes to protecting and defending America, being there matters. And America's Navy is already there.